Good afternoon, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center webinar. I am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC, and your host. Before we talk about today's topic and today's really excellent guest, I want to tell you that I had an amazing experience on Tuesday. I was invited to do a webinar for our sister organization, the Republican Jewish Coalition, with the amazing international lawyer and Israel advocate, Eugene Kantorovich. We'll be posting it on the JPC website shortly. And I want to encourage you to go there and listen to Eugene. He took us on a trip from Greenland to Panama to Hungary and then to Israel, Gaza, Judea, and Samaria, and hit on the ICC and the ICJ along the way. It was a really extraordinary tour de force by Eugene Kantorovich. So go to our website and take a look. Now, today, however, we are back with Syria and Turkey because not only has nothing been resolved as far as Syria is concerned, but things seem to be moving farther out of hand. The first orgy of revenge killings appears to have died down, but please do not mistake that for calm for the future. Turkey and Damascus are negotiating a peace treaty that would allow Turkish troops to operate in the country, and Turkey has begun looking at controlling an airbase called T4 and deploying air defenses there to, as Turkey says, stabilize Syria. Israel looks at all that and sees an entirely different set of circumstances emerging. So, our outstanding guest today, see, I had an outstanding guest on Tuesday, but I have another outstanding guest today, is Hazem Al-Gabra, a former US State Department official with roots in Syria. And he brings us a perspective that we probably have not had, and I can't wait to do this. So I'm going to go short on the JPC introduction, and we'll get to Hazem. The Jewish Policy Center is a nonprofit organization established in 1985. We support a strong American defense capability, close U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. Most important today, we support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. And now more than ever, we support the government of Israel and the IDF in its defense of the people of Israel on all of its borders and occasionally beyond those borders. And we support justice in Gaza, which may start with the return of the hostages, but it will not end there. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, energy security, free speech, and intellectual diversity. You can find us on our website, as I mentioned, jewishpolicycenter.org. That's jewishpolicycenter.org. You can read our insight columns. You can see our magazine, In Focus Quarterly. The spring domestic issue of In Focus has gone up, and it's really quite terrific. And you can also binge watch our former webinar programs. Cup of coffee, glass of wine, binge watch, it's good. And now our guest, Hazem Al-Gabra, born in Damascus, Syria, is the founder and president of Frontiers Consultants, a Washington, D.C.-based consultancy firm that provides public relations and crisis management with a focus on the Middle East and the United States. Hazem has held multiple positions in the U.S. State Department, including senior advisor for public health in the Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs.
Public affairs, sorry, public affairs.
Sorry, my apologies, Hazem.
Yeah,
He is a
it's
frequent
okay.
commentator on a wide range of television stations, including I-24, Al Arabiya, Sky News, and the BBC. BBC really needs him because they've gone off the rails and they need somebody smart like Hazem to keep them in line. So, Hazem, I don't even know how to phrase the question. What do we need to know? You've been watching Turkey, you've been watching Syria, and you've been watching the way they come together. Tell us what we need to know to start with Turkey and Syria.
Great question, Shoshana. Thank you for the introduction. Two quick points regarding BBC. If you go to Memory's website and Google my name, you'll see some of my conversations on BBC that are interesting, to say the least, and my arguments with them.
That's really important to wait. That's really important to you guys out there. Memry, MEMRI, very important resource for translating Middle Eastern media. MEMRI, do it.
Absolutely. And to plug the Jewish Policy Center, I know you had a short introduction, but I have to talk about the importance of what you guys are doing and other organizations are doing in Washington and elsewhere in the United States, especially right now with the new administration and two key offices, the State Department Special Envoy on Anti-Semitism and the White House Jewish Liaison offices. They're both still vacant. So the role of your organization and others are crucial today to maintain the message and to advise the public and the new government on issues relating to Israel and the Jewish people. Thank you, Shoshana. Turkey and Syria. It's interesting in that region. The more things change, the more they try to stay the same. And we're trying to change that narrative right now. The Assad family has ruled Syria for decades, almost half a century. And throughout that time, the country of Syria and the government of Syria has been in a state of war, either an active or inactive war with Israel. Something that has always been seen by even the Syrian people as unsustainable, yet the narrative was so ingrained in Syria that people accepted it continuously. Now change happened. And I think one of the key questions right now that needs to be posed continuously in Syria is, all right, do the Syrian people want to continue the failed policies of the former regime that they deposed toward Israel? Or are they going to start a new narrative and open a new path to peace with the benefits of peace, whether they're economic or security benefits? That's really the question that needs to be asked continuously. That said, the new rulers of Syria are, at a best case scenario, still they have a very weak grip on the country, and there are elements, external and internal, or semi-internal. You have foreign fighters in the 10 to 20,000 that have a very unique narrative, and they have terrorist affiliations, and also there are regional players that are very involved in the decision-making process in Syria. Have the idea of extracting the decision process from that influence is a very complex one, at least at this juncture. We're trying. I'll give you some background about what I've been personally doing. So in January, I was in Jerusalem, and I would love to tell you more about the trip toward the end of the webinar. But one of my biggest focuses was with Syria in general. And we've had multiple round tables. I had meetings with the government, with the Knesset. We've had long conversations. And we came up with a very basic skeletal security agreement that I grabbed and took to, and obviously I didn't take it personally, but I messaged over to the new Syrian government through somebody, I'm not going to mention a name, but somebody who's involved in the new Syrian government, and somebody who was exposed to the good neighbor policy, somebody who was a commander in the Southern Syria Free Army brigades. And I liked this guy because I felt he had the exposure that makes him more trusting of Israel. He took my message through the channels. The request was very simple, honestly. It was good for Israel. It was good for Syria. It created an opportunity to reduce tensions. It's mainly three main points: reduce, or eliminate any transfer of weapons through Syria to any parties hostile to Israel, namely Hezbollah, but others as well, if that happens. The Syrian territory should not be used by third parties to launch attacks against Israel in any way, shape, or form. And the Syrian government will not launch any hostile action, whether it's kinetic or otherwise, toward Israel and its people. Very simple stuff. We're not asking them to do anything crazy. And two additional points that I felt was important, because I was actually in the Golan. There was an HTS truck, the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or the new Syria government truck that was kind of running around too close to the Golan border, and it was hit by an Israeli drone. I was around a mile away from that incident on the other side of the border. So I felt personally interested after I got shook there to add a point that there should be a deconfliction hotline. Somebody can pick up the phone from the IDF, from the Israeli side or the other side, say, like, listen, there's something happening. We don't like it. Let's deal with it right now instead of having a drone try to mitigate the problem. And number two, create a task force on both countries to discuss long-term issues, including borders and cooperation, and including economic cooperation, something very important to Syria. I was all excited. I was like, listen, this is so simple. Like, anybody would love to like work on this. I did not hear for like a month. For a good month, from like toward the end of January till the end of February, I'm like, then I kind of pinged them back. I'm like, listen, guys, this is silly. What is going on here? And I got a polite but a negative answer. Like, specifically said, we're only dealing with Israel through official channels. Now, we all know there are no direct talks between the Syrian government and the Israeli government. So an official channel will be through a third party, and obviously that third party is Turkey. I did not really believe that was the most helpful approach. I mean, at the end of the day, Syria and Israel share a border. Turkey and Israel do not. I feel it's more prudent of the Syrians to have a direct conversation. However, my answer was very clear and final in a way. But this tracks because around a month ago, the acting Deputy Assistant Secretary for Syria in the State Department went to a meeting in Europe and handed the Syrian government representative a list of very simple demands. Mainly not having the foreign fighters that are a global concern. Taking leadership positions in the Syrian army, along with other points regarding cooperation on Iran. Things, again, in my opinion and the opinion of the US government, are very basic and very obvious. Well, the same thing happened again. No response still. And this is, I mean, we're not talking about like, poor little me. We're talking about the US government that holds sanctions, the key to removing sanctions against Syria. Still no response. This is creating an impression in Washington that the decision-making process is not owned by Sharia, is owned by other, again, internal or external, likely both parties, Turkey being a key player here. And that is a concern because we're not sure what Turkey wants, Shoshana. Not because we're at this juncture, we don't know what they want. We've never figured out what they want. They've,
That's
for
always
years
been
and
true.
years, for, go ahead.
But when you
Sorry?
say that, I said that's always been true. But when you say that, it seems that al-Shaarawy is himself not making the decisions. He looks like he is. We like to pretend that he is. But are you saying that Turkey is controlling him, or are there internal factors in Syria that will have an impact on him?
It's actually both with Turkey, because while Turkey it's another country, but Turkey has large and well-funded fighting elements within Syria. They at least have two very well-equipped brigades, the Hamzas and the Amshas, or Shah Sultan Brigade, that were actually involved, according to the Shara himself and his government, negatively involved in the massacre that happened on the west coast of Syria. And to the point where he officially asked these elements to withdraw. They literally showed up, start shooting, like spraying and praying in civilian neighborhoods. And they seem to be largely responsible for a lot of the civilian casualties. And these guys are under Turkish command and control. and they're supported. Like they're, you know, I, it's a bad comparison, I know, but they're like, as Hezbollah is to Iran when it comes to control and funding and support, these guys are to Turkey. They cannot do their own thing willy-nilly. They have to double check with Turkey before they engage. Now, I don't think, I'm not sure, and it's hard to believe that Turkey told them to go kill a bunch of civilians. But at the same time, these are not really super disciplined elements. So if they are, say, like, it's okay to go there, they will go and do whatever they want to do. So again, Turkey kind of like pops up every time we try to talk about Syria. And that is becoming a concern, especially that there's no clear Turkish policy regarding Israel, you know, the relationship between Israel and Syria. Because listen, I am not fully opposed to Turkey being involved in the Syrian-Israeli conversation. But what are they proposing? We cannot sit and guess. This is the safety and livelihood of the Syrian people and the Israeli people. And we cannot sit and, you know, guess what Turkey feels like that morning. We need a clear policy. And we have not seen one. We've seen Turkey take action, and we derive the what we think their policy is from that action. Most recently, the Turkish interest in building air bases miles away from the Israeli border. You know, no bueno. You know, without them having a clear policy, and especially with the continuous rhetoric by Erdogan, by other elements in Turkey, leadership elements. We're talking about, you know, foreign ministers, Erdogan himself, his deputies, with that such negative and hostile diction toward Israel. It's not, it just doesn't make it okay for them to put up F-16s like a mile away, a couple of miles away. And we're talking, I mean, anybody who's been to Israel understands the problem of the strategic depth of the country. I mean, like an F-16 will take like 30 seconds to make it from Palmyra to Israel proper. It's the Israeli concern is very tangible and clear, and Turkey seems to ignore that. So Israel had to go to kinetic with it, and there was, as you know, a massive bombing a week ago, and now, lo and behold, the Turks are having what they are calling technical conversations with the Israeli side. Again, these are very political conversations. They're not only technical, but they're calling it technical, so they don't appear to be negotiating with Israel, but they are.
So
We don't really
let's draw
like
a
that.
stop here for a second, just to clarify. So
Sure.
Israel
Yeah.
bombed the base in which Syria, in which Turkey was claiming it was going to have something.
Correct.
That did not really make the news in the United States. So I think there are people here who may not even understand what you just described because it didn't show up here. But Israel
And
took out.
sorry if I'm going too fast. There's so
No.
much going on a daily basis.
There's so much we
Yeah.
need, like 6 hours of your time. I just want to make sure we've got all the baselines right. So what you're saying is that after Israel bombed the base, Turkey decided perhaps it should talk to Israel about what it's doing
Correct.
in Syria. But isn't it also true that Turkey has much broader interests? You've got Turkish troops in Africa. You've got them flying around in Libya. You do have Erdogan saying very, what should we say, fantastic kinds of things about destroying Israel and taking over Jerusalem. So, is it possible that the Syria problem is only a piece of Turkey's larger problem, and maybe we can't address that yet? I mean, we have to because it's there, but maybe they're not ready to address that except to the extent of shutting Israel up when they need to.
Well, to your question regarding the Turkish global interests, absolutely. And Syria is not becoming that. It has always been that. And the two fighting brigades I mentioned that are supported by Turkey were at some point, and I'm not sure if they still are, fighting in Libya on behalf of the Turks. Turkey literally like airlifted a bunch of fighters from Syria and inserted them in the Libyan theater. So this is an ongoing problem. This is not a new problem. But again, it's hard to understand what Turkey wants. And going back to clarify what happened with what's called the T4, like Tango 4, airport. It's a military airport that was used by the obviously the old Syrian regime and the Russians to some extent over the past years. It's in the southern parts of Syria. It's pretty close to Israel. Not that there's anything really that far from Israel when we're talking about an air base in Syria, but it's concerningly close compared to other areas of the country. So part of the reason people may have not heard of it, because the bombing of the T4 was actually layered in other bombings as well. So it did not, Israel, I think, wanted, there were two objectives. There were other targets that needed to be prosecuted, but also putting the T4 in a package made it look less direct. It was an obvious message, but not like, okay, well, Turkey, this is for you only. It became part of a bigger campaign and an ongoing campaign. So I think that was an interesting move on the Israeli side to layer the T4 bombing in other within other action. And this probably we've heard a lot about bombings in Syria recently, but not that specific base that was visited by the Turkish military a few days before it was bombed. And they were like kind of checking out like the new digs kind of thing. Well, they might need to check it out again because it's the panorama has changed quite a bit in the past week. But
But it
I
should be
digress.
said, it should be said,
So,
those Turkish military
yeah,
officers.
no, I mean this is. Oh no, there are Turkish military officers that are full time in Syria right now,
Right, but
and in Damascus.
when Israel bombed the base, they were not there.
Oh
And I say that because there is a report that Prime Minister Netanyahu has said that once the Turks position their assets at that base, which I guess he's assuming they will do even after this bombing, it'll be off limits to the Israel Air Force. And I think he's trying to make the point that it's not in Israel's interest to bomb Turkey or Turks or Turkish military assets, but kind of control how much influence Turkey has in Syria. So I thought it was interesting that, as you say, the Turkish military people were there. They were investigating the base. They were looking at what they were going to do. And only when they left did Israel decide to change the shape and size of it. So you're right, they have to come back now and see what's left.
Let me add my own spin on what you just said. I don't think anything in the region is off limit to the Israeli Air Force, but the target will become a lot more expensive than it was last week.
Good point.
I think post October 7th, there's a security first narrative that has been, subscribed to by everybody in Israel, the people and the government. So if a Turkish base becomes a direct threat to Israel, that base will be gone at a high price, at a high cost, but that is the cost of what, it's the region tends to like be a different strategic and tactical theater than the US. Here we like to have conversations first, but again, with the lack of strategic depth and the imminent threat that is always there, I think bombing a Turkish base is not out of the question, but not what anybody would like to do. But if they have to, if the IAF has to go down there, then that decision will be made very quickly. But again, I think right now what we really need, and this is where the US role is key. We've heard a lot of compliments by Trump to Erdogan and Turkey. It's kind of nice. They like to be complimented. It's good diplomacy, but again, when the conversation goes technical, it gets complex, and people kind of leave the meeting in Washington less than satisfied. And we're talking specifically here about the Turkish foreign minister who was in Washington last week. Even, I mean, let's call a spade a spade. I don't think anybody's leaving the White House fully satisfied right now, including, Bibi a couple of days ago. So it is what it is. It's an interesting presidency. I like Trump. I think he's doing things. Trust me. I'll take anybody over Biden, but Trump specifically is doing stuff. And by
Definitely
taking
doing stuff.
action, yes. And by taking action, he's gonna succeed in some action, and some action will fail. This is the nature of international politics. We cannot expect Trump to, win every time. But the beauty of it right now, that every time the White House sees a dead end, they're detouring and trying to approach the problem from a different direction. It's healthy, it's good, it's productive, and this is a good government and a good opportunity. I think we need to advise. I think everybody's interests need to be more, well, I think Israel's interests need to be better represented today. It's a problem, and Shoshana, you and I were in a room and we've seen it in person. There is a great Turkish influence here in Washington, especially on the right wing, that needs to be counterbalanced, not countered, but counterbalanced. There needs to, whenever somebody with the NSC, etc., is looking at Turkey, they need to look at the region as a whole and make sure not only the NATO partner is happy, but the most strategic partner of America and the Middle East, which is Israel, is also protected and not harmed by things that may appease another party. And
So,
that includes more pressure, sorry, on Turkey to have a clear policy and follow that policy. Apart from there, Erdogan is going to sell his people whatever he needs to sell his people. I get it. But again, the action needs to be very clear as well if it's going to be different from the spoken narrative. Sorry, go ahead.
one of the ways to do that, you and I were discussing before we got on the air, would be to make an offer in a let's say a different context. There are conversations about air bases, conversations about air defenses, conversations about military things. But you were talking about conversations about civilian things, about trade, about things that the people of Syria need, not things that the Turks need, but ways to go to the people of Syria. And I was reminded that at one point in this life, and I'm old, so I remember these things. There was a good fence between Lebanon and Israel. And Lebanese people would come across the border during the day and they would work in Israeli factories and they would go home at night and live in their homes in Lebanon. And it seemed to be fairly, what should we say? It rewarded people who did things right, not Hezbollah and not actually the Lebanese government, but the people of the region. Do you see that possibility as something that could be built, not today, but over time between Syrian communities and Israel in terms of trade and opportunity?
2 points here. Let me also talk about one thing I've been talking about on television, including Syrian television. There is this obsession with the military in the region. Something that's like, with the new Syrian government, we need to build the Department of Defense. We need an army. They've been including the foreign fighters in an army. Well, first of all, an army, in these Middle Eastern countries, especially Syria, Lebanon, somewhat, and other countries, the army is very different than how we see our army in the US or Europe or even Israel. The army is too involved in internal affairs, which is horrible because an army, unlike police force or, a civilian security force, that is concerned with ethics, concerned with long-term sustainability of a community. A military unit shows up to accomplish a mission and leaves. And that is creating part of the problems we've seen recently. So what my advice has always been, stop being so obsessed with creating an army. Be more obsessed with the economy, obviously, and creating a good civilian police force that will integrate into the community, fight terrorism, and fight other issues. So you don't need to send an army and infantry fighting vehicles to civilian neighborhoods. That is the, and everybody looks at me is like, oh, well, you don't want us to have, I have like this reputation that I'm a Zionist in the region, which is, we can talk about that toward the end of the conversation,
We're
but
going to.
Yeah, like you're a Zionist. Obviously, a lot of people do not know what that means to begin with, but whatever. So you don't want us to be able to defend ourselves from Israel. I'm like, dude, how long do you think it's going to take for Syria to build a fighting force that can at least defend itself from the F-35 program? And by that time, the F-35 will be a museum piece too, by the way. So I'm like, you are trying something that you know will fail, but you are hurting yourselves to try that just because of what looked at as a pride thing. And that we need to fight back. I'm like, no, you need to have an adult conversation, something that Syria has not done with Israel for decades. So again, this is my issue. So as part of that whole conversation I've had with the Syrian side and in Israel, like the Golan is an interesting thing because the Golan is well ingrained in the Syrian narrative, and we need our land back, etc. I'm like, well, first of all, if you've ever been to the Golan, the people of Majd al-Shams are very keen on staying exactly where they are, the way they are. They are very happy over there, and I've met some wonderful people up there with clear, unmistakable interest in remaining as part of Israel and enjoying their connection and their being part of the Israeli community. So apart from that, we need to look at the Golan in a positive manner, not a negative one. I think part of the problem right now, both Israel and Syria are looking at it as a conflict fault line. It's, well, how do we change that narrative? I think the Golan would make a fantastic economic partnership zone, or like a duty-free zone, or whatever you want to call it. A place where Israeli products and services and Syrian products and services can flow across the border. And that will eventually build the trust toward greater peace,
So,
or a greater level of peace. And sorry, one more quick point. One thing we need to remember, that region has been at war with itself for 10,000 years. The one thing that always worked is trade. Even during the Roman times, during the Gilgamesh times, people were fighting each other, and the like merchants from both sides were behind the tree somewhere doing business. So the idea of trade and the economy being a key peacemaking tool is something we need to look into some more. Please go ahead. Sorry.
no, that's good that you mentioned Majd al-Shams and you mentioned the Druze community, which being on both sides of the line, both on the Israeli side and the Syrian side, gives the Druze a certain capability and a certain status, and they like working with Israel. So that's like a positive thought. The other community that Israel has had connections with is the Druze. And the Druze, however, are in a different part of Syria.
So
So
the Kurds, sorry, you mean the Kurds?
Sorry, I meant the Kurds. The Kurds are in a different place. So, could you tell us a little bit about how the Kurds are doing now in the context of the HTS government? We're starting to get a bunch of questions from the listeners, so we're going to jump around here a little bit. But the Kurdish question is really important to a lot of people. So, how are they doing?
People who know me know how, I've always had personal and moral interest in protecting and working with the Kurds, not as a Syrian, but as an American. The Kurds have, in northeast Syria, are our brothers in arms. They fought ISIS with us, they've bled in the same ditches, and they successfully defeated ISIS along our side. You can't name a lot of partners that have been successful in working and partnering with the US in accomplishing a mission in that region outside of Israel, to be honest. So we like the Kurds. However, this is where it gets interesting. And the Turkey again pops in. Obviously, Erdogan personally and the Turkish government has an obsession with the Kurds. It's kind of weird for a country the size of Turkey, with the capabilities of Turkey, to have such obsession with such a small group of people that have not really been kinetically violent against Turkey. You know, the Turkey claims there are linkages between that group and other groups that may have been kinetic against Turkey in the past. But that's a conversation to be had, not something that needs to be addressed with drones and fighter jets, in my opinion at least. But here's where there are four, well, technically five elements at play here. There's the US government and the Kurds on one end. There is Turkey and the brigades supported by Turkey on another end. And HTS, or the Damascus government, sits somewhere in the middle. And what the US government has had, the limited discourse we've had with the Shara government was focused on the Kurds in northeast Syria, to a point where we're trying, as again, nothing is finalized. It's a process, but the idea is we need to kind of work a way where the Kurds can be integrated into the greater Syrian government, but at the same time protect their areas and themselves against some elements within the HTS government, but more importantly, Turkey and its elements within Syria. See, again, everything in that region, and in Syria specifically, we start with one problem, we end up with like five different problems. But we are addressing that cloud of problems right now, and there has been some success. Now, the Kurds, the SDF specifically, were very clear. Okay, we can be part of that coalition as long as we continue to control our own areas at some level, you know, not full control, but partial control, especially on the security level. And we don't want to see any of those Turkish-backed elements, like near our areas.
So that's an important, I got to stop you there because that you just said something important. Turkey had been bombing those Kurdish areas for a long time, and last fall they cut off the water to the Kurdish people. Has the fact of the HTS government changed Turkey's behavior toward the Kurds in the north? Have they stopped bombing them? Are they leaving them alone? I mean, this is another one of those stories that never made it to the American media. Nobody seems to know what Turkey was doing in northern Syria attacking the Kurds. So, what's going on now?
So I'll tell you, while I was in Israel, I received a phone call from my SDF liaison, who's the public affairs liaison, and he had lost friends and members of his public affairs unit in a bombing near a dam on the Euphrates River. So it's ongoing. Now, I don't think the right now, because of that conversation and continuing work between HTS government or the Damascus government. I'm trying to like stop calling it HTS. I'm trying to encourage them to do the right thing. So between the Damascus government and the SDF, so Turkey has backed out a little bit, but we still hear about some operations. They're not as rigorous and continuous and violent as they were. I would say like 8 weeks ago, but there are reports like every few days I hear about casualties during bombing, and usually they hit like checkpoints, you know, and everything is hit from the air, right? But the positive side is we have not seen a much kinetic action between the Turkey-backed elements and the SDF. So those brigades that were actually conducting operations on the ground and skirmishes within Syria, and really hurting a lot of people, especially in December and January,
Right.
we've seen a lot less of that. So there's progress, but that is because of US role as well. Let's not lie to ourselves, because the US is involved. And the Damascus government is benefiting from this. And honestly, I mean, the agreement between the SDF and the Damascus government happened at the lowest point of Ashar's control or tenure in the past 100 days. The agreement was signed hours after the events on the West Coast, the massacre on the West Coast, and was seen to have rescued Shara from a huge or a bigger political backlash within the country. But that tells me that the Kurds, whether on paper or offline, are getting a lot of what they want, which is very useful. And
That
it
is.
seems, again, you have different elements interacting with each other that appear to be friends on one level and enemies on another level. But we need to separate, and this is what I beg everybody to do, because it's useful, to separate the Turkey-backed brigades in northwest Syria from the Damascus government. Because this is what we've been trying to do is, okay, well, there are like some brigades that are loosely affiliated with, they've never really been affiliated with the HTS, and they actually fought each other at some point. And now you have like a different government in Damascus. These are not the same thing. And it behooves us to separate them because they can become enemies in a positive way for their regional security. Sorry, go ahead.
Okay, that helps. Let's throw in the United States here. We have mostly a peripheral role because we are not there, but we have great interest there. Several people have asked the question about Turkey being a NATO member, and I'm gonna answer the first small technical question and then go on to you. Several people have asked, can't we put them out of NATO? The answer is no, we cannot put them out of NATO. The only way to get in and the only way to get out is by unanimous vote. If you watch the voting on Sweden and Finland getting in to NATO last year, it had to be unanimous. And that, by the way, gave Turkey enormous leverage over Sweden, which it wanted. And you can't put it out unless Turkey's willing to vote its own way out. And it's not likely to because it gets the benefits. So, given that, there is a question that arises about US influence in Turkey and whether Turkey's role in NATO would be a deterrent to Israel taking on Turkey if it needs to. Not Turkey in Turkey, there's no chance, but Turkey inside of Syria, because Turkey will then claim an attack on a NATO member and ask for a NATO response. So the NATO thing can really hamper regional progress unless you're Turkey and you see it as a defensive shield for yourself. How does
Well,
Turkey and NATO work?
it's really important to remind Turkey how it became a NATO member. It's been so long, people don't remember that. It was literally the on the brink of being invaded by the Soviet Union. It was like not even the, it wasn't the 11th hour. It was like a minute to midnight for Turkey. And they were like literally induced into NATO overnight just to protect them from a Soviet invasion that would have been catastrophic for Turkey. So we would love some like we would love to get more love from Turkey because of that, but alas, I mean it's they are who they are today. I don't think removing Turkey from NATO is really the best option because that could create a worse version of Turkey that we would not want. So the question is, how do we work with our other NATO allies to reform the Turkish behavior? We'd love to have them in NATO and for them to act properly, but they have acted against the interest of NATO itself, not only the US, especially if you remember the S-400 missile situation, and they cannot get F-35s, hell or high water still because of that decision. And I don't want to get into this is like a 6 hour conversation about NATO and the problems with
Oh no, we
NATO
don't want to.
and European role or the lack thereof and the European countries acting like brats and NATO, but that needs to be addressed. And I think there needs to be, instead of alienating not only Turkey but other NATO allies by saying we need to kick out Turkey, which is, as you correctly observed, it's impossible. Let's talk about specific Turkey behavior and say, like, we would be a much better NATO if Turkey did not do X, Y, or Z. And that is really where we need to have the conversation. It's an interesting one, but again, with the situation of NATO today so shaky in general, I wouldn't focus too much on what is happening on the NATO question as much as like the Turkey problem. Whether it's part of NATO or it's not, there is a behavior problem that is confusing at best and dangerous at worst. That
Now
needs to be addressed by the US and other countries.
I'm going to jump in on that one because you've just said something extremely important. Before we get to your trip to Jerusalem, which we're going to get to, but you said something really important here. We keep saying Turkey, but in a lot of ways, we should be saying Erdogan because there are problems of Turkey that he creates and problems that might go away if he went away. And there are these enormous protests in Turkey right now against him and against his government and against the arrest of the mayor of Istanbul. How do you see the stability of the Turkish state? Because if the protesters in Turkey, and Erdogan is very unpopular according to his own people, if he were no longer the president of Turkey, a lot of this stuff would change. What's the likelihood that we lose him for better?
Well, losing him politically is going to be a bit difficult right now. God can get involved in this. He's getting old. You've seen him. He's walking pretty slowly, and he's not the Erdogan of the 90s for sure. But everybody gets old. But he seems to at least be able to rule for another 5 years. From a physical health level and political level. The thing with Turkey, it's interesting because usually it's hard to change the captain of the ship if there is an economic crisis, but not an economic collapse. If there is a complete economic collapse in the country, that would probably result in greater protests and potentially whether it's an action against the president or a political transition of some sort. Because Turkey is in a tough economic position right now, and that it's under control, if you want to consider it that. Like, people are, again, are not starving. They're like I was joking earlier with you, Shoshana, before that we started in that region. The threshold for economic collapse is different than ours in the West. As long as people have not resorted to cannibalism yet, the situation is kind of under control, even though the currency, look at Iran. By the way, I congratulate the Iranians. They've reached the 1 million rial mark. So
Really?
$1 is 1 million rial right now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I didn't
Remember,
know that.
like last time, probably I spoke to you a couple of years ago about this, it was like 40,000 rial. So the Iranian currency is free in free fall. The Turkish currency is in free fall, but you don't see that big, interest in changing leadership, a widespread. And remember, we really focus sometimes on Ankara and Istanbul. Turkey is a big country, and Erdogan has huge support in rural areas and smaller cities than he does in educated city centers. He's a populist with a religious twist. So he is okay. We need to work with him. We definitely need to work with him because what's even more dangerous than Erdogan continuing to do what he's doing is to set up the field for his like nephew or one of his close confidants to take over after him. And we'll end up with a younger, probably more aggressive person on the same policy. We need a policy change by Turkey, and we need partners to do that. We need the Europeans to do that. If you remember, like a few years ago, we were having a very different conversation when Turkey was interested in EU membership, and they're like, "Oh, we want to change the course." Well, look at it where we are now. So, how do we have a new conversation to say, like, "Okay, well, Turkey, you want this, you want that." And maybe quiet down the diction, especially regarding Gaza and Israel. It's dangerous because he's a leader. we cannot separate Erdogan from Turkey, because when he says negative things about Israel, he's creating a whole generation of people that hate the Israeli people and the Jewish people. And that is dangerous. That is not good. That's not productive for Turkey or Israel or the rest of the region. We need to be very clear on why we do not want him to go and yap his mouth about these issues at every in a very dangerous way, in an escalatory way. That is, it's not okay. It's just not okay. It's not helpful. It's not good. It's not healthy.
One could hope that that was part of the conversation the State Department had with the Turkish Foreign Minister last week. You can hope. Hazem, we're
Hopefully.
starting to get close to the end of our program, and I wanted to go to that last bit that you and I had discussed. You traveled in Israel, which I think must have been interesting at many levels for a person who was raised in Syria, although you had already been in the United States for a long time and been an American citizen for a long time. Tell us what it felt like for you to go to Israel and see the reality of Israel, which I suspect was a little different than what you were raised to think.
Definitely. I mean, even and it's not me about being Syrian. It's about me being somebody who's never been to Israel, and the misconceptions about Israel are far-reaching beyond the people who are of Arab descent. People like myself who worked on Israeli issues at the State Department was had the wrong information and wrong understanding of, including on things like security measures in Jerusalem. If you hear a lot of the conversations from any side that's never been to Israel, I'm talking about Jerusalem, you'd think Jerusalem is this like a fortress where you go run into a checkpoint every like 10 meters. Like, I showed up not concerned really about safety as much as about like how much time do I need to allocate to go between East and West Jerusalem, because there are people who want to make you think this is still 1967 in Jerusalem, and there's like a checkpoint between E and it's. I'll tell you, if you have friends who are interested in the Middle East in general, who want to learn more, they need to physically go to Jerusalem. It's impossible to explain how you feel in a country that, on US television, it's at war, you see conflict. But if you actually walk the streets of Jerusalem, go to like Sira pub, you see young people, Arabs, Druze, Jewish, people visit, like visitors, Asian people, sitting together and having, smiling and, and it's a very young society and a hopeful society. These things cannot be explained by somebody who's been there or using video. You need to be there to understand that Israel is, and I said it at the Knesset, and people seem to like this. There are a lot of countries in the Middle East. It's easy to make a country. You make like a nice border, you draw a nice border, you create some kind of government, and you have a country. Israel is a nation, and that is important. Nation includes people who are working towards common goals, who are happy, who trust their government, and their government trusts them. Despite you see protests, you see issues, but again, the people of Israel are united, they're positive, they are producing, which is also very important. A lot of people, you go on the train in the morning, people are going to their colleges, to their jobs. It's a viable economy, it's a viable society.
To
People want to tell you,
and
because people try to tell you otherwise, often, continuously, especially after an October 7th. Sorry, go ahead. You cut up.
I was thinking that that is, I would like all American government, excuse me, all American government officials to have your attitude, which is that you need to go to a place to understand the place. And it's especially true of Israel, but it's not only true of Israel. And it helps us to put the US relationship with Israel into its proper perspective. And I think it's very important, and I appreciate it. And People who listen to this program know I like to go out on a high note. I always try to go out on an optimistic note. So, Hazem, you are my optimistic note. Do you see the future of the U.S.-Israel relationship embedded in that positive nature of Israel? Are we going to good places here?
Again, the past, especially the past 2 years, year and a half, has been revolving around conflict and war. Obviously, we need to navigate away from this, despite the fact that war is continuing and the hostages are not back yet, and the Gaza question remains unanswered. You bring a very good point regarding congressional delegations and trips, official trips to Israel. Big part of the problem, I mean, finally we have an embassy in Jerusalem, Shoshana. It's always been Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv, I mean, I don't know about our listeners, but I do not feel Tel Aviv is the best representation of Israel.
I
Jerusalem
love
is, in
Tel
my
Aviv.
opinion. It's a bit too loud for my taste. It feels too much like Europe in a certain level, and I don't know. But here's the bigger problem. We send Codels. They go, I don't know, a few hotels in Jerusalem. They walk. They go to the Kotel. They go to the old city, and that's it. That is also not Israel. I would love to like run a Kodel at some point, take them to Haifa, take them to the Technion, have them meet the students, whether they're Arab or Druze or Jewish, and everybody's working together, working on projects together. I think there's a part of the Israeli society that remains hidden while it's in public view. I would like to take them to Majdal Shams to meet the people of Majdal Shams and see the economic development in that area. And have my good friend, I made a good friend. His name is Nawaf Abu Jabal. He's a general contractor, like a big contractor though. Like he builds like cities or towns. And he's one of the most trusted contractors in Kiryat Shmona, and his Druze. And the whole idea that the Arab media would like to present that Kiryat Shmona is this like fortress where if you're not Jewish, you cannot even enter. Well, Nawaf and his crew, like it really, I think, the plumbing over there relies on Nawaf more than anything. Like, if it wasn't for his expertise and good, getting things on time, we'll have other problems beside, like, Hezbollah
So
missiles there. So,
I want to go on your
you
de I
gotta
want to
meet
go on
these
your
people, you gotta
delegation.
meet those guys.
I want to be on your delegation.
I'm proposing you run the delegation, Shoshana. It's your delegation. It's not mine.
No, it's going to be yours, Hazem. We're going to go together. We're going to go together.
And I want to say something that, risking me being laughed at, but I've developed an addiction to something called Elite Coffee that I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with. The Elite instant coffee?
Yes.
So Afikai Adrai, who's a good friend and he runs the Arabic Public Affairs in the IDF, told me to my face in a meeting that I should not drink it because only divorcees and secretaries drink it. I don't know what he meant, but anyways, I like it and Amazon Fresh has it right now. So it's a little like this is not sponsored by Amazon, but this is what I'm having right now, and I love it. It's good. It's good instant coffee for the lazy people like myself. So there's that.
So it's good to know that as you drink on the program, that you're drinking an Israeli product. I think that's great. I am going to
I
stop
am.
us
It's
here
good.
because it's 1 o'clock. And I want to thank you. It's been very enlightening all the way through. I still don't think we know enough about Turkey. I think I'm going to have you back again to talk about Turkey again because it just keeps evolving and Syria keeps evolving. But for the moment, I want to thank you for a very enlightening program. And to our listeners, I want to say Shabbat Shalom, a blessed Friday, happy and healthy Passover. And if I don't get to you before Easter, a very happy and healthy and blessed Easter as well. Thank you for joining us. But most of all, thank you, Hazem, for a great program.
Thank you. Thank you to thank the listeners too for indulging me for all this time. Appreciate it, everybody. Thank you.